Hello and welcome to the RTÉ Rugby Podcast. The Six Nations is back, and so too the return of what some people say is the greatest sports podcast ever made. My name is Hugh Cal. Beside me is RTÉ Rugby editor Wes Liddy. Raf Diallo is an RTÉ sports journalist with me in studio. Later on, we're going to hear from Johnny Holland, Tom English from BBC Scotland to get the inside track there, and Fiona Coughlan ahead of the start of the Women's Six Nations on Sunday. I say the greatest podcast ever. Maybe that's a stretch. Possibly the greatest RTÉ podcast ever, or RTÉ podcast this week that involves rugby.
It's the greatest podcast, rugby podcast ever,
this
presented
week
by a horse racing presenter.
I tell you what, we'll take that and move on. Raf, how's the form?
It's good, yeah.
Are you excited about the return of the Six Nations? And look, just bear in mind that, and I'm saying this as a rugby fan, and we have a lot of Champions Cup rugby between the World Cup and now. After the World Cup, I didn't want to look at a rugby match for the guts of 3 months, and that's just been straight up where I was. How are you feeling about it?
Well, there's always a bit of intrigue now. Obviously, we're moving into a new era. Well, maybe not completely new, because obviously Andy Farrell was a voice within Joe Schmidt's camp anyway, but
yeah,
it's what this new era is supposed to look like. Obviously, looking at the first team that's kind of come out, and you know, you don't see Cooney starting, and maybe it's not as big a surprise. Donal Lennon was saying he wasn't hugely surprised by it, given there were no kind of warm-up matches beforehand, but maybe that dissipates it a little bit. But at the same time, you know, once a hangover passes, there's always that period where there's a bit of space to have a bit of interest in something. And again, Six Nations time, you know, it's always exciting.
I mean, it is a new era, Wes, but it's not really, because Andy Farrell has been a huge voice. I mean, how big that voice is maybe is up for a little bit of debate, but certainly he would have been the first crutch that Joe Schmidt would have leaned on in a lot of decisions. You have Easterby in there, you know, some things
I think keep going. I think there was probably one extremely dominant voice in Joe's time. So I think it is new. I think it's new across the board, as it is after all World Cups. I think you have 4 out of 6 teams with a new head coach. And I think the team is a bit of a departure, you know. So Rory Best gone as well. He was obviously mainstay for so long. So look, it is a new era. Mike Catt's in there. I mean,
Rory Best gone straight to pick up the pension for old. I mean, like, Rory Best should have been gone 6-7 years ago. I mean, he went.
His form certainly
terms.
Dipped the last couple of years. That's for sure. Like, the one who I feel bad for in it all, and look, maybe you can say he's had the chances and hasn't capitalised on it, but I just think, and I'm not saying his game is perfect in an all-round sense. He has very obvious flaws that we all know about. But how a guy with the natural talent that Sean Cronin has the Hall of Caps. Now, he's a good Hall of Caps, but they're almost exclusively off the bench. But I mean,
I've never been able to understand.
We just don't produce athletes, you know, big guys with fast twitch fibres like him in this country. So to have one there for 10 years,
I've never.
You just wonder how it didn't come to more, you know.
Yeah, is there a absolutely. Sense maybe his face just didn't fit?
And that has been levelled at him and at Joe Schmidt and at the Ireland camp. But I don't understand what people mean by that. Like, what does it mean to say that our best athlete in a number 2 jersey doesn't fit? Did he personally annoy Joe Schmidt? Was there stuff outside? Like, you know, this is all speculation, but nothing was ever said that ever justified.
I think
that
maybe
question.
Joe wanted guys to present in a certain way at times in terms of their approach to training and off-field issues, and maybe he was a little bit more freewheeling than others at times. But
okay, well, look, I suppose we're not going to get stuck into that, because it is a new era. And I was being a bit tongue-in-cheek, you know, when I was referencing the backroom staff that continue to stay there. They have shifted roles. The starting team is interesting. But before we get into that, just generally the Six Nations this year on the back of the World Cup. I mean, England will be a lot of people's favourites. Wales making a semi-finals again with a new coach, Wayne Pivac. France, a new era under Galtier as well. And apparently the French cap is just one big happy place in the south of France at the moment. So there are a lot of things to look forward to over the course of the next 6-7 weeks, Raf.
Yeah, quite intriguing. A lot of head coach changes, obviously 4 of them. And then also backroom team changes as well. As you said, France appearing to be a happy camp, a lot of video and stuff coming out there, and a lot of it centres around defence and their new defence coach Sean Edwards, who had done good work with Gatland. So, but again, they're a very young team, so it'll be interesting to see how they get on. England, of course, brought in Proudfoot, who had, and it's almost like bringing in the person who defeated you, because obviously he was involved with South Africa. So that's another interesting one. You look at Italy, new captain Parise is going out, I suppose, ceremoniously towards the end of this tournament. And of course, Wales as well, with a new head coach, new era. And obviously, Wayne Pivac was involved in Scarlets, who played quite an exciting brand of rugby. So we might actually see them playing a certain style again. And it'd be good to actually see that.
George North picked it outside centre today, which we'll come back to a little bit later on, which is an interesting call. But for you, I mean, we've been saying this, Wes, like you and I have been saying this for the last 6-7 years to each other over a pint. It'd be great to see France have a good tournament.
Yeah, I was going to say it before you even got there. For me, that's by far the most exciting thing. I've been a massive fan of Galtier's right back to when he was with Stade. I mean, that's a while ago now. It was kind of, they were at their peak, 03, 04. From talking to people in the French media over the years, it seems maybe he's such a confrontational guy at times that maybe with the Federation, he didn't have the most allies there in terms of, it seems like he should have got this job 10 years ago
should
in Ottawa. But, you know, Bernard Laporte was probably the one guy in the last 20 years that brought some structure to France. He's there as president, very much, very openly looking at this 2023 World Cup. He has the right coach brought in. Their backroom team is full of big names. Rafael Ibanez is team manager. If Sean Edwards and Galtier combined can bring that rigour and discipline to the French approach without compromising some of what they're good at, like, it's a...
They've scary amount of talent.
Well, I mean, you look at the double under 20 world champions. You look at your Intermax, your Dupont, you know, Vakutawa there, Jalibert,
Ngandebe, the new guys that brought in.
Brilliant, loads of athletes, brilliant players, like guys that we maybe associate with playing in the typical French way. One interesting point, we had Mike Prendergast in on Against the Head on Monday, who's obviously working with a lot of them in Racing, was that traditionally they don't take kind of harsh or confrontational criticism well. French players would be possibly a stereotype, but one that has some truth in it.
Confidence players.
And maybe Sean Edwards' style would be at odds with that. But Mike is saying in his experience that these kind of golden generation, for want of a overused word, that won these under 20 World Cups are much better than previous generations of French players at actually taking criticism on board, reflecting on their own performances, doing their analysis. And, you know, as always with France, there's a lot of strands there. But if the strands come together, maybe not this year, but really, really looking forward to seeing how it all shakes out in the next 3-4 years.
And Johnny Sexton spoke about that a little bit as well when he left Racing. You know, Sexton's confrontational style, the Irish lads will be well used to it. You know, with Leinster, you know, wanting the best standards to raise across the board. And if you didn't hit the mark, he'd bollock you out of it. He took that attitude to France and they kind of went, well, what are you going to do?
Mike actually reckoned Rog played a big part in it at Racing, and he maybe didn't get the benefits of it, but he kind of brought in a baseline level, and now they're building on that and driving on again, you know?
Okay. And obviously they're working with a very, very young team. I think of the 42 initial squad members, 19 were uncapped. So it's a blank canvas. There's a lot of
130-year-old.
There's no kind of older players there, bar the 130-year-old who aren't a blank canvas that you can kind of mould and maybe develop in a certain way and maybe have a different attitude to ones that have come before.
And even taking them to Nice out of Marco C, which is traditionally seen as an area and a place that the players didn't want to go to. Like, they'd go begrudgingly and the French camps weren't somewhere where they particularly enjoyed. It was a master's joke. It seems obvious, but nobody has done it so far. He said, look, I'm getting him out of here. New mindset, new approach. And the players seem to have responded. So look, it'd be great to see France do well. We said it every year. Like, France, the Six Nations need France to do well. Hopefully this is the year that they manage to do that. And what a game first up, Le Crunch against England. We'll get back to that a little bit later on. But we do have an Irish team. Raph, do you want to go through maybe some of the big changes, if you like, or the big talking points from Andy Farrell's first team?
Yeah, so obviously Rory Best retiring, that's opened up a slot. I was kind of interested to see whether Kelleher would make the step up, because he obviously had an explosive start to the season in terms of try scoring. They've gone for Herring instead, which probably is just more of a question of stability. Larmer at 15, that's essentially, he did have opportunities there during the World Cup, but obviously the fact that Kearney is now being phased out means I think that 15 shirt is his. I had seen the Ulster fullback as well.
Being Will Addison.
Will Addison being kind of linked with that position as well beforehand, but it might have had something to do with Larmer's foot injury as well. But it seems Larmer has that now for the foreseeable future. I was surprised to see Aki back in there as well. Actually,
At
the expense of Henshaw. Because for me, maybe just to, you know, sometimes when you're looking at, say, soccer, the teams have done well in World Cups and things like, you know, the Spain of 2010, they tend to build around a club side. Now, again, there's a lot of Leinster players in the squad, I think, in the starting team, I think 8 of the 15, but you'd almost think maybe would it be better for It's something Arsene Wenger used to call automatisms, where you're almost doing things off instinct, where you have a lot more players in there. And maybe, you know, maybe Kelleher should have been in there, given there's a system you can kind of build around that they all know about. And maybe, you know, maybe more Leinster players. I know some aspects of the media probably wouldn't be quite big on that, but maybe doing a bit more of that might add that kind of level of automatism.
Okay, let's start on Kelleher, because there's a few interesting points here that I'd like to discuss. He's on the bench, so he's fit enough to play, and Andy Farrell has gone for Rob Herring. I'm a bit disappointed, if I'll be honest. I think the way that Kelleher has played,
he's more exciting, for sure.
Yeah.
And I just whether he's better, I don't think is as nailed down.
Well, okay. Well, the question I would ask is, why hasn't Rob Herring got in the team before now? If Rob Herring deserves to be in Ireland starting international now, surely he would have been good enough to replace Rory Best, who for the last 3 years has been just holding himself together and has been, you know, getting older and older with each season.
He's, you know, from what you hear through the grapevine, who knows the truth of him, but apparently there was times that in Ulster they wanted to start him ahead of Rory, and maybe national imperatives took sway in those decisions. I don't think he's necessarily going to come in and set the world alight. And I suppose with Kelleher, there is that upside, particularly in that dynamic sense, in terms of, you know, his try scoring record was obviously amazing. He's a good ball carrier. But I think as well, you know, I think it's, I don't want to say easy, but I think you can shine in that Leinster team the way they're going at the moment. And, you know, when you talk to coaches, or it's a cliche and it's trotted out all the time, but I mean, there is still a step up to international rugby in terms of space available, in terms of your time to make decisions. So, you know, I don't think it's guaranteed that someone's going to necessarily bring that form, particularly a guy that form was 2 months ago. Yeah. So,
well, there's two ways you can look at that. One is that, okay, you know, it'd be easy to look good in a Leinster team playing so well. The second is that actually to stand out in a Leinster team that has so many lads playing well takes an awful lot of good rugby. And I kind of fall down on that side of it. Like, to stand out in an Leinster team that is unbeaten, breaking records, scoring tries for fun, and this lad only just into the senior team, but Wes, he seems to have everything. And I know what you're saying, there is a step up.
He does.
I'd love to see him get a go, and he will get a start in the Six Nations. I think he should be now.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I probably thought he would start, being fair. I think, I'm not quite sure of the background, but he maybe hasn't been in his best form either. But I mean, if you'd asked me 6 months ago who the long-term replacement for Rory Best is, I probably would have said Niall Scannell.
Yeah.
Now, he's not as dynamic as Kelleher either, but he's a good player. He's a very big hooker.
Tough, hardy lad, though.
115 kilos, good scrummager. But apparently, you know, I've talked to guys in Leinster who train with Kelleher all the time, and apparently he's very, very solid in that regard as well. A powerful guy as well, you know.
Yeah, I would have seen a bit of him in schools as well, playing for St. Michael's. But look,
obviously Doris as well.
It's the other big inclusion.
I suppose the big news.
Jamie Heaslip said...
that's a very exciting call, though. 21, number 8. I mean, that's a big call. Like.
Jamie Heaslip said today, look, he is the best number 8 on form in Ireland at the moment.
Well, Deegan was very, very highly rated when he was coming through from under-20s.
Yeah.
And immediately the next year, people were already saying, geez, Doris might be better again. So... he has been flagged, and in fairness, I think CJ has done well when he's been able to carry a little bit wider. That freedom that playing at 6 as opposed to 8 has given him at times too. So absolutely, it could actually be a bit of a masterstroke.
I think Stander has excelled when he's gone to 6. It's taken away that ball carrying role that number 8s have to have, and he's been targeted because of it. And people say maybe a little bit too one dimensional CJ and a bit predictable, but 6 will free him up to do other things that he does really well: tackling, getting in around, supporting players. And I think it could be a brilliant combination, those three.
Yeah, could well be. Especially, I suppose, there had been question marks as well around Peter O'Mahony's form, like even during the World Cup, and he had been kind of a mainstay of that back row. Obviously, he's gone now. Stander, as you said, yeah, there have been questions about him being one-dimensional, but I think that was maybe down to the type of support lines he runs, and also...
And the game asked to play as well.
Yeah, and not... Yeah, obviously the...
I think he was a bit of a victim of his own success at times, too. Like, he was almost too earnest for his own good, in terms of he constantly wanted to present for carries, and Joe wanted a workhorse that he didn't necessarily care about him making line breaks. He wanted a guy that carried 20 times for 1 or 2 metres as much as anything. And yeah, he took balls on when he was static, he took balls on behind the gain line, and yeah, it did become predictable and one dimensional, but I think it wasn't solely down to him, and he might benefit from being used a little differently.
Yeah, Peter O'Mahony as well, by all accounts, when he told he was on the bench, straight over to the computer to help Caelan Doris, to help the younger guys in the team. the mark of the man, really. And look, maybe just needs a bit of, not motivation, maybe just maybe a bit of kick in the back. So I just say, look, come on, if you want that jersey back, everyone knows how good he is. Just got to hit that form.
And he's a good character as well, by all accounts. Obviously, has yeah. captained Munster, of course, and is a leader himself. And yeah, no, it is a good, it's a good sign that, and probably good positivity for the camp as well, that there are those older players that have been kept there but are not starting yet, are willing to, I suppose, impart their knowledge to, say, the Dorises of this world. And you always need something like that within a camp.
Ian Henderson is an interesting one, Wes, because he didn't have a great World Cup. Probably the bar is set very high because we know how he can play when he's in his best wrecking ball form. The problem is we don't see that too often. And he kind of reminds me a bit of Mushy Buckley in that the lads are constantly going around saying, listen, you have it, you have it. We just don't see it enough. Mm. What do you make of Henderson over the last kind of year or so?
I think in rugby now, particularly when you're coming from Ireland where, you know, let's be honest, the kind of genetic base we're picking off, it's not inclined towards, you know, power athletes. You know, let's say what you typically expect in an Islander. Guys with size, but also with just that power to win collisions, to break tackles. We don't produce a lot of them. We get one every 10 years if we're lucky. You look at, you know, maybe Cian Healy falls into that category. Maybe Sean O'Brien. David Wallace probably fell into that category. And I think Hendo has a bit of that. So, like, for me, even if the rest of his game isn't up to par, I think you need three or four guys that can perform that role. Now, Jean, I understand Klein, what you're saying, he's inconsistent. I think Klein is a different thing.
No, I mean, yeah, sorry.
It's a different type of power. But I think you need that explosiveness in a couple of your big men throughout your pack. Like, you know, or otherwise you run into the same problems we have when we meet in England at their best, when we meet in South Africa at their best. You know,
is the criticism of Henderson fair then, do you think? Do you think that he just doesn't deliver on all the talent and power and attributes that he has on a more consistent basis? That's the accusations that's leveled.
He has been good for Ulster this year, in fairness to him. Yeah, I think it's probably fair enough when you first saw him, what you expected of him was so high. Maybe he hasn't fulfilled that. But I think, you know, second row as well, it's a hard, he probably would have got more opportunities to have those eye-catching moments if he continued at six. And certainly compared to the best second rows out there, you know, for the last 10 years, it's been Brody Retallick. It's probably slipped over to Mauro Toje now. He doesn't have the kind of those guys' impact on a game when they're on top form seems like completely all-encompassing. They're everywhere. Yeah. And no, there's no doubt he doesn't impose himself to that degree. But look, that's a high bar. He's just, you know, probably there's no shame in him not being as good a player as Brody Retallick either.
Yeah, and he kind of does strike me as a kind of laid back character from interviews and things that I've read over the past, especially when he first started out. So maybe that kind of plays into it a little bit. You know, there are probably more intense players, your Johnny Sextons or whatever, who are
James Ryan to have alongside him well is someone who'll just go all day long.
I think Atoja is redefining the role there as well. Like, I mean, if you look at second row, you could argue it's the most changed kind of basic skill set on the pitch in the last few years. I mean, Retallick obviously brought huge amounts to it in terms of playing first receiver, in terms of getting on ball in wider channels. I mean,
even Victor Matfield before him as well was that type of mould.
Decathletes almost of the rugby team, where they're doing a bit of everything. So it's like, I think Atoje is actually bringing it to kind of new place again. He's probably not as good a footballer as Retallick is, but I mean,
as an athlete though.
It's incredible the impact he has on games, you know.
Okay, Raf, probably one of the most surprising calls, and I say this because everybody had flagged up that Doris was going to start the night before. It was kind of in a lot of the papers online before the team was named, but not one of those papers had Bundy Aki in ahead of Robbie Henshaw. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's a strange one. He didn't have a great World Cup. Obviously, that's obviously been coloured by the colour of a card, of course, that he got against Samoa.
And the jersey was playing him because nobody really had a great World Cup.
You know, there was that as well. And again, I suppose, back to the point I was making about automatisms, there's a relationship there. I mean, why was Henshaw brought to Leinster in the first place to work in that triumvirate with Sexton ahead of him, I suppose, as the 10, and then alongside Ringrose, and that's supposed to be the development that's supposed to happen. So for me, I would have always kind of gone for Henshaw because, again, you have those interlinked relationships where they're working on the training ground at provincial level, but also then they can carry it over into international. And it just, in terms of instinct and everything else, it just makes it a bit easier, especially when it comes to things like attack and maybe playing a less structured game as well. So technically, I would have always played Henshaw over over Aki in that position.
And, you know, I, again, for this season as well, Connacht have struggled. So maybe, Wes, it's hard to paint a picture of Bundy being better than Henshaw when you just put the two teams side by side. But equally as well, like...
I don't think there's actually much between them, if I'm being honest.
Yeah. This is a surprise, what I'm saying. Is this as big a surprise as people are making it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, they haven't had to compete against each other that often. And the assumption has always been that Robbie would get in there. Why that assumption was there, I think there could be a couple of different reasons for. But, yeah, I mean, look, I think Bundy's probably a good international player, but maybe not the colossus he can be at Pro 14 level at times.
Shane Horgan has his biggest criticism has been his passing off his bad side. And it does seem, you know, on occasion that he's either reluctant to do it, or when he does do it, it's not as good as Henshaw's as a footballer. As
yeah,
kind of passing
but in fairness, like... Robbie Henshaw has been painted here for a number of years as if he's, you know, Tim Horan in his prime. I mean, is his are his football skills, his passing skills, that good?
Fair question. Fair question. Yeah.
Like, it's not to knock him for no reason, but
he suffered as well. Wes, for like,
I don't
12,
think he showed
13.
Himself as a true world class 12.
Yeah.
Do you?
Well, I always thought 13 was his best position because he's a powerful, strong runner. His reading of the game on the outside channel is brilliant. That was where him and Bundy Aki set the world alight. Well, did I say the world? The Pro 12. But that's, you know, that was a key ingredient of that success. And I think he has suffered from being put out of position into 12, being forced to adapt there, then kind of changed when it suited Ireland or maybe even suited Leinster. Then we had that ridiculous experiment of fullback against England where he got absolutely destroyed because he hadn't played there before. Perfectly fine.
He's a little hung out to dry there.
He suffered, I think, for being asked to do too many things. The main one of which was play at inside centre when his best position was 13. So I think we've yet to see the best of him.
Yeah, maybe so. But I mean, as of right now, do you hold him comparable to the two centres that came before him? Dricko and Darcy?
No. Not at all. Okay, fair point. Right, that's it. I mean, look, Conway picks himself. Larmour, the fullback jersey as well. Addison is an interesting one. The bench as well for Scotland this weekend. John Cooney, Ross Byrne, Robbie Henshaw. We have to talk about, quickly before we move on, about John Cooney against Conor Murray. I mean, the world isn't smother saying John Cooney should start on form. But clearly, Andy Farrell just still very much trusts Conor Murray, and given how he played last weekend, probably saw enough to say, yeah, you know, it's not as bad as perhaps people are making out.
Yeah, and it's probably not just a choice of picking for one position, but looking at who's playing a 10 as well. And there is a long relationship there that's been built up between Murray and Sexton. And also, I suppose, Cooney's style in terms of he essentially runs the game for Ulster. Sexton as a 10, and I suppose we have the cult of the 10 here as well, whereas the way Cooney plays the game, it's more like what you hear about, like, you know, the French nines, where, or was it the term, the Le Petit General or whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Can the two, I suppose, can there be a symbiotic relationship between those two? So maybe that's what is playing into Farrell's thinking. Also, Cooney's not particularly experienced at that international level, and didn't have any warm-up games to really test anything out. So maybe... it might be the tour to Australia in the summer. Maybe we might actually see some more experiments because it's possibly too soon for Farrell to experiment.
Yeah, I guarantee there isn't going to be one person in the Aviva with an Irish jersey in the back in the crowd saying, oh God, I'm worried about Conor Murray.
No, I mean, look, there's a bit of the class is permanent analogy there about Conor. Like, he has had a little dip in form, no doubt, but it might be just the thing to get him to refocus for the last couple of years of his career. You're talking about a guy who was, you know, widely considered the best scrum half in the world up until what? 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm. His dip in form coinciding with Ireland's dip in form.
Yeah, and also I think, you know, of all the racket you hear for John Cooney, I'd love to know what percentage of those people have actually watched 80 minutes of Ulster's games religiously throughout the season.
Yeah, it's a fair point.
And he does make some mistakes too. So, yeah, look, his form is more eye-catching, but I don't think it's, you know, outrageous that he would want to persist with Conor Murray by any means.
Yeah, I think it's more outrageous that Roman Keller hasn't started anyway, but that's just my opinion. Right, okay, we're going to come back to Scotland, as I mentioned, because we do have Tom English to come as well as Johnny Holland. Before that, Raf has been talking to Irish Women's Grand Slam winning captain from 2013, Fiona Coughlan, currently RT analyst. Firstly, about the factors that came together to bring Ireland success all of 7 years ago.
In fairness, I suppose it was the squad that had developed over the time. There was lots of experience, but some fresh blood as well. And we had a really strong management squad as well, who'd come together and been together for a number of years as well. So, you know, there wasn't a huge amount happening outside the national side at club level. So it was very much about the squad there. And we knew how good we could be. It was just a matter of it all coming together on the day. And I suppose in that championship, well, the first game was a bit dodgy, but after that we just kept improving. And I know the last game wasn't exactly a spectacle, but we knew that we were good enough to win and we had to do it in horrific conditions. But at the end of the day, we had a nice shiny trophy. I think since then, I think in general, the landscape of women's rugby has changed immeasurably across the board. You now have professional teams, the standard of competition's gone up, the whole profile around the game has gone up, and the squad in the last couple of years have been in a transition. You know, new coaches, new players. Now there's a bit of stability, but now they have to bring performances and get the wins under their belt, particularly this year. It's such an important year for them.
Yeah. Fiona Steed was making a point recently, I think it was last year, in regards to the AIL being kind of a good bit of a step down to international rugby. Do you kind of share those concerns, and what solution do you think could be there to maybe bridge that gap?
Yeah, look, the AIL is a significant drop down, so is the Interpros. In fairness, they're trying to look at the Interpros. They've done home and away this year, so increased number of games, trying to improve the standard and the positioning of it at the start of the season allows more time, coaches more time with players to develop them. They're restructuring the AIL as well, which is only going to be a good thing. More teams coming in, and again, hopefully rise the standard of it. Teams and clubs that want to be in it and want to develop it, and certain frameworks around the level of coaching, the level of support that the teams need. So in fairness, it needs to happen if you're trying to keep up with the likes of England, who have professional team, but then a Tyrrell's Premiership that's a really strong competition that has huge exposure, huge numbers and a really good standard. And that's where we need to get to. And again, it's brilliant now to see young girls playing, which never happened in the past. Like, you know, it's great. There's minis, there's schools, there's clubs underage. And I think that is going to stand to Ireland as it develops. But unfortunately, we need it to happen at a quicker pace, because the pace of international rugby is, women's rugby is just accelerating at a rate of knots.
In regards to last year's tournament, before we touch on 2020, it was a bit difficult for Ireland, obviously, finished fifth. Never really got going. What was it that specifically went wrong? I know defence has been one area that they're looking at, but overall, what were the key factors that you would pull out?
Yeah, I think there was probably a lack of everyone being on the same page at times. You know, you had people moving in and out of the 10 position. I don't think there's been a consistent 10 since Nora Stapleton has retired. So if that player is not getting enough amount of game time, it's very hard for them to slot into international level, particularly if they're not playing a club level of 10. To slot in at international level and try and dictate the game, that's very tough. Like, I never ever comment on an Irish women's team of lack of effort or lack of want, because I know that's just inextricably there. They're getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, but just they were off the pace. They weren't on the same page. Yeah, it was like they were working on their own as opposed to each other. So, you know, I love the fact that there's an honesty out there, that they seem to have recognised that, and hopefully that we're going to see an improvement this year.
And there have been changes to the backroom team. So Adam Griggs has brought in Kieran Hallett and also Stephen McGuinness. Do you know them by reputation, and what do you expect them to bring to the table?
Yeah, to be honest, I didn't know them at all. It's just from hearing what's going on in camp. The girls seem to be really happy with the defensive structures that they're bringing in, and forwards are happy with what they're doing. So there seems to be a cohesiveness. And this is from the outside. I obviously haven't seen them play since the Welsh game in November. So what happened last weekend in Wales, I don't really know, but they did get a good win over there. So yeah, I hope to see those improvements, that as units they're on the same page, whether that's a forward unit, a back unit or a defensive unit, and then as the team that they're all on the same page and that they implement the game plan that's put in front of them.
And when it comes to momentum, obviously they have two home games to start off, which could look like an advantage, but is it as big an advantage? Because the year you won the Grand Slam, again, you had away and home.
Yeah, look, there's no denying that home fixtures definitely stand in your favour. And I think if you look at stats around that, it definitely shows it. And particularly in Donnybrook, there has been really good crowds going out last year, record-breaking crowds to see that more. But just looking at the teams and where they're placed, those three home games are games that they can and should be winning. Okay, whatever about England or France, home or away, they're currently at a different level than Ireland are. So those three home games, they're must-win games in my eyes to put themselves in the right position where they need to be for qualification for the World Cup competition.
And are England clear favourites in your eyes?
Based on what they've been doing and their on 2019, they look like favourites. But any team that goes to the south of France to play France, you just never know what you're going to get. I think definitely England are probably a more complete team. They've had more time together. They've got that really good balance of experience and then some good youth coming in. So they're definitely probably the favourites, but I would never bet against France playing in the south of France in front of what will be a huge crowd. So I think it's going to be a cracking first game.
For Ireland, can there be a benefit from, I suppose, the sevens contingent that are sometimes brought in? Or I know back in 2014 you kind of stood up essentially to the IRFU and kind of wanted a bit more focus on the 15s, but can there be, what's the pros and cons, I guess?
I suppose for me, if there's no problem sevens girls coming back in, but they have to be in training. So if you look at anything that the sevens girls currently, they're away, they've been away January, they're away at the moment, so they haven't been in training. So they're not, I'm not saying that they're not skillful enough or not good enough, but again, they're not going to be on the same page. And while they might be able to turn a game on a counter attack or something, I just don't think that's good cohesiveness for a squad to have people dropping in and dropping out, and you know, people who haven't trained with them and taking someone's spot who's been there training. I don't think it gels. I don't think it works. So I would rather that they don't come back in, to be honest.
Okay, so that was Fiona Coughlan ahead of Scotland on Sunday. It's live on RT2 television, and Fiona will be in the commentary position as the Ireland women's team start their Six Nations campaign. Important year it is too, bearing in mind that World Cup qualification is far from secure. Also, Radio 1 Extra will have live commentary. And Adam Griggs has named his side just as we talk. So Aoife Doyle, former sevens player, is coming back to the 15s game. She's going to get her first cap and is in the back three at fullback. Bavin Parsons on one wing, Lauren Delaney is actually fullback, and Aoife Doyle on the wing. So Emma Considine doesn't make the team, and just going through, she's not in the squad either, so I can only presume that she's picked up an injury. She's one of Ireland's standout players. Emma Considine not in there. That's the standout news. Sene Nupu and Michelle Claffey in the centre, Ellen Murphy at out half, and Catherine Dane holds off Nicole Cronin at scrum half. Into the packets pretty much as you are. No Claire Malloy, she's taken a year out but hopes to be back in order to qualify Ireland for the World Cup, or at least do her best to hope to qualify Ireland for the World Cup. So she'll be greatly missed. But yeah, it's a strong enough team. As I said, no Emma Considine, which is a bit of a surprise, but you can only imagine that she is injured. Sunday afternoon live on RT2 television from Donnybrook Stadium. I'm delighted to say we have Tom English from BBC and Johnny Holland, of course, on the line with us. You're very welcome, guys.
How you doing?
We're good, good. So, Tom, can I just start with you and I suppose get your sense of what the mood in Scotland is like ahead of this weekend, given what happened in the World Cup, given the last meeting between the sides, and I suppose everything that's happened in the build-up to this game with a certain Mr. Finn Russell.
Yeah, listen, that's dominated. Not too many people have been talking about the match. Everyone's been talking about Finn Russell and what's been going on in the background. I'd say there is a sense of nervous anticipation. There's no expectation at all. I'd say Scotland would probably settle for a respectable defeat, a defeat that kind of went to the wire. I think they'd take that. Recent matches against the many oppositions against Scotland have played, the games have been over inside an hour. A lot of the games against Ireland have been over inside an hour. So if they took it to 80 minutes and lost, they would sign up for that now. There's very little, outside of the squad, there's very little expectation of a victory.
So when you say no expectation, does that transfer to not much pressure on Gregor Townsend, or is it actually the opposite given how the World Cup went?
Oh, no. I mean, inside the squad, it'll be a different story. And no, there's huge pressure on Gregor Townsend. There's huge pressure on Gregor Townsend on the back of the Finn Russell affair, even though I think a large portion of the blame there rests squarely on Finn Russell's shoulders. But, you know, the World Cup was a flop. The Six Nations preceding it was a flop. If this is another flop, then they go to South Africa for two tests and New Zealand for one in the summer. That's going to be 0 from 3. So it's not looking so good for him at that stage. So I think he needs to get a bit of credit in the bank in the Six Nations, or else it could be a very, very troublesome first 6 months of the year for Townsend. He's, you know, I think it's fair to say that he is fighting for his job here.
Can I just ask you, because you have the inside track on what exactly happened with Finn Russell? You know, it's been kind of documented over the course of the week that it involved a drink when he came from Racing after the Saracens game, and a disagreement with the coaching staff and even some of the more senior players. What exactly happened?
It goes beyond just a few drinks in the bar on that Sunday night. There's been a difficulty in the relationship for quite a while. Maybe upwards of a year. Russell thinks that Townsend is overly hard on him, that he makes him a scapegoat when things go wrong. Townsend would say that that's nonsense. But certainly Russell has felt under pressure. Now, Townsend thought he had got this thing sorted out the day after Russell was, you know, had those drinks in the bar. They had a meeting, 2 or 3 hour meeting. Townsend thought that everything had been resolved. They spoke at length at a pretty deep level. And the day after, Russell announced that he was heading back to France. And that really surprised Townsend because he thought the clear the air chat had worked. Clearly it hadn't. Clearly there are a lot of issues between them. It's just, I think that the drinks in the bar were ill-advised. But I think that was just the straw that broke the camel's back. This thing has been going on for quite a while between the two of them.
Okay, all right. So, Johnny, I suppose, just to bring you here in this, you know, if Andy Farrell had a wish list ahead of Scotland this week, surely, you know, Finn Russell not being available for whatever reason would be right up there.
Yeah, absolutely, especially coming from a defensive point of view where he has come from. I think it's a lot easier to defend against a team that you know what they're going to do or you have a good idea what they're going to do. But I don't know if anyone knows what Finn Russell is going to do, and he can definitely pull some tricks out of the bag. So it's probably a good thing that he isn't playing for Ireland, but at the same time, Adam Hastings isn't bad. Like, you know, and he's still got a little bit of flair about him. He can still do some pretty special things. So it's not exactly easy because he's gone, but it's definitely easier.
Yeah, and in terms of how Scotland might approach this game then, I mean, look, I kind of reading that Gregor Townsend has wanted to kind of shift the style of play from anything goes off the cup, keep the opposition guessing under Finn Russell to a more structured game plan and perhaps a more kicking game plan. How do you think that will affect the Scots' performance, Johnny, this weekend?
I probably think it'd be a good thing. You know, like they have a bit of flair there anyway with, you know, Ali Price is able to break from the base of a ruck. Hastings can do a bit. But then you've got Stuart Hogg as well, who's able to take fellas on one-on-one and get in behind them and get an offload away to fellas who are well able to finish outside them. So you don't need to be throwing the ball around to have a kind of a flair in your team and your back line. If you can give these lads structure and allow them to play in the opposition territory, and then your guys like Stuart Hogg can start to bring his own bit of individual flair while looking after the ball, which he does, then I think you could get a good outcome. But it's going to be very hard to outstructure Ireland, I think, especially the way Ireland have been. But, you know, they're going to look to play a little bit differently as well. I just don't think they're going to start throwing the ball around for the sake of it either, you know.
So, Tom, what's your sense then of the approach? Is it that Scotland will be more disciplined and more structured, but not necessarily trying to outstructure Ireland, as Johnny just said?
Yeah, I think they'll try. I think they'll try to be. I think they will try to play the game in Ireland's half, rather than trying to this Hollywood stuff in their own 22, which has seen them come unstuck too often. I think they will try and be a little bit more pragmatism, but still retain that kind of attacking ethos that Townsend believes in so much. The big mantra coming out of the Scotland camp is stay in the game, stay in the game, stay in the game. Because they have played themselves out of games so early in so many times in the last couple of years. And, you know, the mantra previously was, let's play the fastest brand of rugby in the world. Now what you're hearing, and you heard it today when Gregor Townsend announced his team, and you heard it a few weeks ago when he announced his wider squad. He said that he wants to make Scotland a nightmare to play against. Now, by that, he means we have to sort out the defence, because the defence has been porous for a nation supposedly in the upper echelons of world rugby. Scotland's defence has been embarrassing for quite a while, shipping tries all over the place, soft tries. You can have the greatest attack in the world if you want, but then they do, but they have a decent attack. But when your defence is as bad as Scotland's has been, then you've got no chance. So I think the huge, huge lesson of the last year has been, if you don't improve your defence, Scotland, you're goosed. And I think Townsend is goosed unless the defence improves dramatically. They've got a new defence coach now in place for this tournament. They've also got Peter de Villiers, the former French prop, in looking at the scrum. So there has been coaching changes, all, I think, with a mind to improve that defence.
And Tom, what's your sense of Adam Hastings' potential? I've seen a lot of him at underage level for Scotland, under 20 level in the World Championships, and I've seen him at Glasgow. I'm a huge fan of his. I think he didn't miss a kick against Sale last weekend in the Champions Cup, albeit a weak in Sale's side. But again, they scored 45 points, Glasgow. Do you think that... how will he handle the pressure this weekend going in that 10 jersey, knowing that Finn Russell is out of the team?
Yeah, I think... you know, he's a very composed guy off the pitch. I don't think the stress of the occasion is going to get to him. He's playing very, very well, Hastings. But when he gets under pressure, So, you know, when Van der Fleer and Doris and Stander start running at him, pressurising him, he has a tendency to make poor decisions. We've seen that a lot. He can blow hot and cold. He's still learning. Mm-hmm. You know, this is really his first season in frontline rugby. So he's got a lot to learn. He can be brilliant on a day, or he can be very poor. He can be very vulnerable. I think what Townsend likes about Hastings, he likes a lot of things about Hastings, but Hastings will stay in the game for longer than Finn Russell. So Finn Russell might go through 3 or 4 or 5 phases and get a bit bored, mm-hmm. and try something risky. He'll try a Hollywood play, and if it comes off, everyone says, wow, isn't he special? And when it doesn't come off, it could cost Scotland a try. Hastings will stay fixed in the game plan for longer. So through 7, 8, 9, 10 phases, he'll follow the game plan. And I think Townsend likes that about him, and certainly Dave Rennie, his coach at Glasgow, likes that about him. I mean, I spoke to Dave Rennie at the start of the season. I say, you're gonna really miss Finn Russell, who's moved on to Racing. He said, no, you know, Adam Hastings has the potential to be as good, if not better, than Finn Russell. And he outlined this theory that he's a more disciplined player, and he's a better team player.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll see. This is the biggest game of his life, Adam Hastings, so we'll see how he copes with it.
Johnny, he's playing in your position at fly half. I'm just interested in your thoughts on how good potentially he could be. And equally as well, I'm delighted that Gregor Townsend went from. There were some calls during the week that Duncan Weir should be brought back in. I was thinking, oh God, if Scotland bring Duncan Weir, that's a massive step backwards. But I don't know how much, maybe that was tongue-in-cheek, the calls that I heard. But what do you think of young Hastings?
Yeah, he's good. Like we said there, he looks composed. He looks like a very confident guy, but... again, it's a step up for him, like, you know. So when you get the likes of Van der Fleer running at him, bringing the line speed that he does, will he make those good decisions? And that's probably the question mark that's over him at the moment. But that's the question mark over every 10 when you step up a level. Can you make the decision at a faster pace? I think he can. Like, I think he's a good player. He looks pretty impressive when the flow is there. It's all coming through him. But like that, international rugby is more structured again, and it's harder to get the opportunity. So will he be as hot on taking every opportunity instead of that kind of league or European level when you don't get the... you might get more opportunities to take, you know what I mean? So I think that's obviously the question mark over any player that's coming through, but especially with him now in that position, if he can answer those kind of questions, then I think Scotland will be onto a winner there.
And Wes, you know, I'm sure Andy Farrell will point out to the Irish pack, if you get on top of the Scotland pack, as you did in the World Cup and as you did for the last couple of times you played them, then Hastings isn't going to enjoy 1 ounce of this game because he's not going to have the front football that he requires.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think you shut that down early, don't you? So... when the lads are coming at him, I think you know, if they can get off the line and defensively put him under a lot of pressure, that's going to be it's going to be a lot harder for him to pick his space.
It's funny actually, just to go back to Mike Prendergast again on Monday off the camera, he was saying he thought Finn was the most talented player he's ever worked with, which if you even look at some of the players he's currently working with in Racing, guys like Fakatawa or Teddy Tama, mm-hmm. is saying a lot. And he said it was exactly what Johnny said. He said it was his ability to wait till that last moment before making decisions and executing when to release the pass so flat was what caused defence's problems. And I suppose it's kind of interesting from the outside that there's so many obvious similarities between Gregor the player and Finn Russell, maybe in some ways kind of both seen as kind of mavericks and maybe not you know, game managers, but you know, Gregor the coach seems to have a different kind of personality. But you know, if you look at kind of when Scotland kind of started to improve a bit, maybe starting 5 or 6 years ago, I suppose it was very much driven by a kind of resurgence with Glasgow initially, which Gregor was to the forefront of. And, you know, they possibly got rid of a very good coach in Vern Cotter a little prematurely to facilitate that.
Fiji to win the next World Cup, by the way.
Progression for Gregor.
Yeah.
And, you know, now you look at it, the way the World Cup just went, you know, the stuff with Finn in the news and, you know, even things like the CEO deciding to pay himself 900 grand a year lately.
Yeah.
You kind of wonder, with a few losses, does this become, you know, a really bad situation for Scotland on a number of levels?
What do you think, Tom, of that?
Listen, I think it's a really bad situation for Scotland already.
Well, yeah.
You know, they bombed out of the World Cup. They had 1 win out of 5 in the Six Nations. There's no expectation. But, you know, none of this is new. Scotland in professional rugby have been a disaster on the international scene. You know, they've been hopeless. they've had nothing to get their teeth into. They won a championship in 1999, and literally in international rugby since then, they have done nothing. So I think this team has a potential to get some results, but you know, I look at they're decent players. You know, there's some good players in here, some good young players, Fagerson and Cummings and Ritchie. There is a good core of players here, but unless the defence, and I keep going back to this because it's the absolute heart of it, heart of the problem, if the defence isn't bolstered massively, then the defeats are going to keep coming, and Townsend is going to lose his job, and these players are going to lose morale, and the whole cycle is going to be another decade of failure, and then another decade of failure. It's all about the defence, and Townsend has been stressing this. We need to stay in the game longer. Stay in the game longer. You look at the World Cup game was over after, you could say, 20 minutes.
Tom, is there any sense...
31 points in half an hour against Twickenham against England. The game against Japan in Yokohama is over after 45, 50 minutes. This is what's happening. This is what happens to Scotland. Now, sometimes they rally. They rallied against England and got a draw. They rallied against Japan, still wasn't enough, still lost the match. But they're so slow out of the blocks. And if they're slow out of the blocks on Saturday, Ireland are going to put up a score and Scotland are not going to catch them. And it's just a recurring theme. So these are grim times for Scottish rugby in the international scene. But it's been grim for 20 years.
Is there any sense, Tom, that regardless of how bad things go for this current team or for Gregor, that it was kind of such a grand plan that there's kind of nowhere obvious to go for the Union as a replacement?
I think you mentioned Vern Cotter there a minute ago. I think a lot of people in Scotland were kind of holding out hopes that that Cotter would come back, because there's a lot of people, that decision to get rid of him was sat very uneasily with a lot of folk. I think there is, if it comes to it, if they do fail in the Six Nations and they fail on the summer tour and a new coach has to be found around autumn time, I think there's a pretty obvious choice. Richard Cockerell. I think there's a very, very good chance that if they have to make the decision, that they will elevate him up from Edinburgh to the national job. If he could, as a proud Englishman, if he could deign to coach the Scots. I suppose if he's coaching her in Edinburgh, he wouldn't mind stepping up.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe Mark Dodson could give some of his 900 and something odd £1,000 sterling and maybe hire a proper defence coach. Okay, I won't ask you for your prediction then, Tom, but just in terms of the Six Nations overall, before I let you go, and I want to talk a bit more with Johnny, but who do you see? Are England the standout candidates to go and win this? Or would you agree with myself and Wes that perhaps France could do something a bit exciting this season?
I think France could. I think if they win the first game... Yeah. They could win the championship and even a Grand Slam. It's so hard to know with France. I look at the squad and I think, wow, this could be something incredible. But I've said that before. If all these guys are as good as I think they are, a lot of people think they are, then my tip would be France. But only if they get past England first.
Okay. Listen, Tom, great stuff. Thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
All the best. Take care.
Super. Tom English there from BBC Scotland. Johnny, give us your thoughts. We've been debating the Bundee Aki versus Robbie Henshaw call. And Wes and Raph both basically saying, look, they're not as far apart as perhaps has been suggested in certain quarters. Do you think that Andy Farrell made the right decision, or what's your overall thought?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think the most interesting part of this is that Gary Ringrose has nailed himself up to the 13 position. Before it was Robbie Henshaw's in and who's going to play with him. And I think Gary Ringrose has just turned that all around. So in fairness to him, he's taking his chance. The other position, I think it is a toss-up. Like, I'm not sure how much rugby in total the two lads have played, but you know, you can see Ireland didn't really work without Robbie Henshaw before. They didn't have him for the whole World Cup, and Bundee Aki seemed to be a big player and a big leader in that team. Like, so it is a tough one, but I think with the Six Nations, like, what you're seeing in the first week might not be what you see for the whole thing. Like, I just think it's a tournament where you get guys game time. You don't look at it as a starting team as such. Obviously, you go and you pick your strongest team and what they think. But I think it's the combination of game time across all players, across the tournament, is one of the most important parts of this. And that's the whole Conor Murray and John Cooney debate as well. Like, there's nothing saying that John Cooney's not going to get two starts and a couple of appearances off the bench, while Murray still gets
maybe one extra start, but a lot of their minutes could be very similar, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
You still don't know what way the selections are going. It's one selection and then, you know, there's a lot of debate about it. But I think once the selections are backed up with another one and maybe a third one, you get to see what the coaches are actually thinking as opposed to just one selection, especially when, you know, there's a little bit of a chat around whether guys were fully fit, and especially Cooney in that one with HIAs. And there's a big discussion in it, but very hard to tell from one selection what way the coaches are thinking for the whole tournament as well, you know.
And do you think we're going to see a different style of play under Andy Farrell, a more relaxed approach where perhaps the whole playing by numbers diktat isn't as enforced as it was under Joe Schmidt?
Yeah, I would think so. Like, I think he's going to get them excited about playing again. And I know Andy came into us in Munster for a while, and it was just, I feel he coaches with a lot of kind of personality and feeling within what you're doing as well. Like, you know, it's very easy for Irish people to, you know, we talk about defence as an emotional thing and an attitude, but he kind of said to us, like, why aren't we doing the same thing with our attack, and why aren't we feeling excited about it and bouncing up into the attacking line the same way we do in the defensive line, because we think that's an attitude base, but so is attack, like, you know. And if you're willing to work harder, then you're going to get more opportunities. So I do think he's going to give them not so much freedom, but I think he's going to bring a bit more emotion into it, as opposed to, like you said, playing by numbers and just waiting for the other team to crumble. I think he's going to give them a bit more decision making, and hopefully they can take that on board and get used to it all of a sudden, because when you play without decision making, it's very easy to get into that kind of rhythm and you think you know what's coming, and when it doesn't work, you're kind of scratching your head. Whereas if you can get the decision making right and get the lads taking that on board themselves and taking control of that, obviously with a bit of balance, that the coach needs to have an input, but I think if you can get that, you've got really good talented players there. Like, it's such a good squad of players when you look at who's been left out. Especially, like, I'm not sure what the story is with Will Addison, but when you see his decision making and how balanced he is running with the ball in hand against Ulster, or with Ulster, it's mad what's left in reserve, you know.
Well, listen, does Jacob Stockdale need a big Six Nations? Because he does seem to be carrying a bit of credit in the bank for past performances, individual brilliance, perhaps to unpick defences and score tries. But his defensive performances have raised questions, his decision making as well over the last year or so. And if you look at the potential Ireland backline, if Will Addison comes into the mix there at 15, that might see Jordan Larmour shift to the wing alongside Andrew Conway. You could say they're the three foreign players. Do you think Stockton needs a big tournament?
He definitely needs a big tournament, but I think it's everything is changing so much at the moment that anyone who has a big tournament could be nailed on for the next World Cup cycle. Like, you know, you'd hope that it doesn't go like that and it goes by form, but I think if you can really stand out in this tournament, because everyone's expecting so much change, if you stand out now, then it's going to put you in good stead for the next couple of years. But Jacob Stockdale, yeah, he's got credit in the bank, but he is so dangerous. Like, I mean, you can't ignore the credit that these guys have built up. You know, it's there for a reason. They have that quality, and they're able to make big plays. I mean, he was, look at the kind of chip and chase that's become his thing, that he scored tries with against New Zealand, you know. So you can't really ignore that. But at the same time, you know, he does need to perform. But you look at some of the big guys that didn't perform in that World Cup, there just seemed to be a bit of a curse over it, and there was no real form there. It's very, very hard for players to pull themselves out of that. So, you know, this fresh start for guys like Jacob Stockdale, Conor Murray and these guys, it might just be all they need to get back to their kind of top form, you know. So I think you see how it plays out, but if he doesn't have a top tournament, then there's enough guys to be standing in his position, so he'll find it hard to get back in if he doesn't have a top performance.
You're 2020 Six Nations champions, Johnny, before we go. Who do you think is going to win it?
It's going to be tough. I think Ireland are lucky this year that they've got Scotland at home to start off with, because if you look what happened last year, England coming to Dublin and getting the win, I think it was a huge statement, and they went down and got stronger and stronger from that, and Ireland declined from there. So I think it's the first fixture matters quite a bit. If France can do a job in England, they look very dangerous, but I'm not sure they're going to have the kind of form to keep that up through, or the consistency to go through a whole tournament. You can't look away from England again. If they go to France and get that big win, then all of a sudden they've got new fellas in their squad, and they're bringing a bit more of a blend of experience and new guys coming in with a big win away from home in the first round. So I'd find it very hard to look away from them. Wales coming in under the radar as well, but very hard to see England not winning it if they win at the weekend.
Okay, this is great stuff, Johnny. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Super, Johnny Holland there. France have named their team. Anthony Boutier, the Montpellier fullback, starts at 15. Teddy Thomas on one wing with Damien Penault on the other, Gael Figu and Virem Vakatawa in the centre, Entomac and Dupont the half-backs, the front row Cyril Boyle, Julien Marchand and Mohamed Hawass, who comes in for his debut as well. The second row is Bernard Leroux and Paul Valemza, another Montpellier player, Francois Crow, Charles Olivon is the captain at 7 and Gregory Aldrete. That is a team that can beat England. I have no doubt in my mind they can beat England.
Not sure if it's a pack that can beat England.
That's why I think they can. That back row will do damage. Without Vunipola as well, I think that back row will do serious
I think
damage.
England, if England are at their best, they're the best team in it, I think, heading into the tournament.
Yeah.
But he put so much store on the World Cup for 4 years publicly, Eddie Jones, that you just wonder, do they kind of reach those same heights again immediately?
He's been quiet this week as well, hasn't he? Uncustomably. Yeah,
Wales are set up quite nicely too, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think there's so many doubts about the four main contenders, let's say. It's very hard to call. I think the momentum will play a big part in it.
Okay, right. Your overall thoughts?
I would tip England. I think, obviously, their doubts have come from partly as well from the way they kind of deflated in the World Cup final. But up to then, obviously, I think everyone remembers the All Blacks game. Like, they were imposing, they were imperious.
It's the best English performance I've ever seen.
One of the best performances I've ever seen. Yeah. And if they carry some of that that in, and obviously, as I said, they brought in the forwards coach that helped defeat them, that might be just the extra bits they need, really. And I know, obviously, look, they're playing away, which is always quite difficult in the Six Nations, but I would still tip them. Again, it's a France team that's young and it's been built for 2023, so are they quite ready for now? Well, we'll see.
All right, before we go, the under-20s in action Friday night, live on RT2 television as well, from Cork. The general consensus seems to be, and I've seen a few of these lads, not all of them, Pack are very strong. The backs maybe not as good as last year when they won the Grand Slam. What's your sense of them?
It's hard to know because, you know, they followed up a Grand Slam with, I suppose, a pretty disappointing World Cup, one of the most disappointing in a long time, really. So,
crippled by injuries as well, though.
You know, it's... Does that alter anything to peak later in the year? Probably not. You know, is it still a case if you're looking for one or two individuals to put their hand up as opposed to success for the team, that being a bonus? Thomas Clarkson returning from last year at tighthead's very highly rated. Mm. You know, it's funny though. I mean, he's a 110 kilo tighthead.
I think light.
There's a good 15 kilos to go on there yet before you're putting him.
It's all
in
about
an
technique, though, Wes, isn't it? You should know that
it's,
as a hooker.
It's about technique when the guy opposite you is the same size as you, but when he's got 20 kilos on you, it becomes a little bit about something else too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, it'll be interesting to see how they go. Home game in Cork, as I said, Irish Independent Park, Friday night television, RTE2. That's about our lot for our opening edition of the rugby podcast ahead of the new season. Plenty of twists and turns to come. Ireland against Scotland this weekend to kick us all off. And my thanks to Raf and to Wes. Cara O'Hare was on sound. Gary Moran was our producer. And we'll talk to you next week.